Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on August 6th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus video update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update with Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice, and I am a health reporter at the site, and I am here to answer your questions about COVID-19 and give you a few updates from this week's news about the virus and the ongoing pandemic. If you would like to see what I'll be discussing at the top of the show, we have a description in the writing above this video if you want to check that out. I usually start off with about half the show being those news updates from the week, and then I hop into your questions partway through. So if at any time during the live stream you do have a question, please stick it in the comments below, and we will try to get to as many as possible in the midst of this stream. Just to give you an update on the current case counts, worldwide there have now been 18.8 million reported cases, and 708,000 reported deaths associated with the virus. Here in the U.S., we see that more than 4.8 million cases have been reported and more than 158,000 deaths. These are based on the Johns Hopkins virus dashboard. So these numbers, these tallies might differ between different databases depending on what sources they're using and how up to date they are in that moment. But the Johns Hopkins dashboard is generally fairly up to date. Note that the death count throughout the pandemic has been predicted to be a slight undercount, at least slight, of what the actual death count is, given that we don't know every single person who has caught COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. On to our first update, I wanted to talk about cross immunity from coronaviruses that cause the common cold, symptoms of the common cold. So what do I mean when I say cross immunity? I mean being exposed to these other coronaviruses of varying description may confer some immunity to this new coronavirus that emerged just last year. So you can think of this as a way that the body has become primed to better fight off the new infection. And there is very preliminary evidence suggesting that the four common coronaviruses that circulate through populations every single year and cause symptoms of the common cold, these might help the immune system to recognize the new coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. This might partially explain why some people remain completely asymptomatic, meaning they don't go on to develop any symptoms of illness when infected with the virus. And it may help explain why so many people have very mild infections where they may only experience at most a very mild fever or slight coughing, things of this nature. When I talk about immunity, some of you might be thinking about antibodies right away, which are molecules that the body generates in response to exposure to a new pathogen. And these Y-shaped molecules seek out that pathogen specifically and grab hold of specific proteins on its surface usually. And some of them recruit additional immune cells to come attack that pathogen. Others can prevent the pathogen from infecting any additional cells. So these are called neutralizing because they neutralize the pathogen. We're not talking about antibodies here, though. We are talking about a different layer of the immune system known as T cells, and specifically memory T cells. So memory T cells, once exposed to a new pathogen, also learn what that pathogen looks like. And what they do is they, next time you come into contact with the same pathogen or a very similar related one, those T cells help to mount a faster, more robust immune response by calling inflammatory substances to the area, calling immune cells to the area of infection, to try to snuff out that infection right away from the start. So this is the kind of cross immunity we're talking about in the context of these common cold coronaviruses, is that we see that T cells seem to recognize the new virus based on what they know about those other coronaviruses. And this is based on a study that included blood samples from people collected between 2015 and 2018. So before this new coronavirus ever emerged, and they looked at the T cells present in those blood samples and found that the T cells contained within can recognize more than 100 specific sites on the new coronavirus, meaning places on its surface or within the virus that can be recognized as kind of a red flag by the body. And then the immune system reacts to that. And they also recognize similar sites on those common cold coronaviruses. So this is good news in a number of ways, where it indicates that we might be getting closer to understanding why the virus presents differently in different people. Again, this is fairly speculative at this point. This has been talked about from the start of the pandemic as to whether past coronaviruses might influence immunity to this one. So that's kind of a cool new tidbit that we have learned this week. Another thing that we're learning more about currently and in ongoing studies is called convalescent plasma therapy. I'll just call it CP therapy for the sake of this live stream. So convalescent in CP therapy just simply means it refers to a person recovering from an illness or a surgery. So what convalescent plasma therapy is you're collecting blood plasma, which is the liquid portion of blood separate from the red blood cells within it, etc. You separate that plasma out from blood, and that plasma contains antibodies to the virus that the person has just recovered from. And you give those antibodies to a person who's still sick. So it helps to boost the sick person's immune response by essentially borrowing tools that the body generates itself. And this type of therapy has been used for at least 100 years, specifically in the context of major pandemics. So going all the way back to the 1918 flu pandemic, and again in the SARS pandemic of 2003, and even the H1N1 epidemic of 2009. So the thing about CP therapy, though, is that because it often is used in the context of these kind of emergency situations, it's very difficult to organize robust clinical trials testing the therapy. So even in this case, a new study came out this week, which was posted as a preprint, meaning it has not been peer-reviewed, that offers a very preliminary overview of what we know so far about CP therapy for COVID-19 patients specifically. And it includes an assortment of studies, some of which meet the gold standard for testing new medical interventions. So the gold standard is known as a randomized controlled trial, which means that anyone enrolled randomly either receives the treatment in question, in this case, CP therapy, or the standard of treatment, which may include at this point remdesivir or other symptomatic treatments for the virus alone. And then you compare the outcomes between those two groups while matching patients within. So you would want to compare patients of the same age ranges and same sex, things of this nature, same pre-existing medical conditions, all that sort of thing. So only three of the studies included in this mega analysis met that standard as a randomized controlled trial. The others are observational studies where they are either lacking a control group, they're not randomized, so the conclusions drawn from them are not as robust. You can't establish cause and effect. All that said, looking at preliminary data, it looks like hospitalized COVID patients do benefit significantly from being given plasma therapy. Specifically, the mortality rate among those given plasma therapy was about 13%, whereas those given standard therapies alone had a mortality rate closer to 25%. So that's a more than 50% reduction in mortality connected to CP therapy. Again, huge grain of salt on all of that, given that very few of these trials they looked at were randomized and controlled. This just goes to say that there are many randomized controlled trials of CP therapy underway at this moment. There's a huge one being organized through NYU, for example, and these will give more robust data as to, for instance, when CP therapy should be applied and in which patients. For instance, would a patient already in the ICU benefit most from plasma therapy? Or if someone has the right pre-existing medical conditions, would you give the therapy to them earlier? These are the sorts of questions you can get at with more controlled trials, but it is positive to see this reduction in mortality so early on. So you can read more about those studies in detail on livescience.com. Just to wrap up our updates, I did want to talk about new evidence that has come out surrounding heart damage and COVID-19. So a study that came out at the end of July in the journal JAMA Cardiology. Again, this was a small study, so another grain of salt on that one. But it found that a high proportion of COVID-19 patients, both those who had been hospitalized and those who recovered at home with a fairly mild infection, appear to have lingering heart damage or heart abnormalities as a result of the virus. Now, the huge question is, do these abnormalities in the short term translate to long-term consequences? We don't know yet because it hasn't been that long since these patients have recovered. So that's a question that they will follow up with in future studies. So this particular study, just to zoom in for a moment, focused on 100 adults between the ages of 45 and 53 in Germany who had recently recovered from COVID-19. About a third of these patients were hospitalized and the other two-thirds had milder disease and recovered at home, not at the hospital. So within the context of the study, MRI scans of the patient's brains, or hearts rather, not brains, thinking of a different study, were taken 2 months after their diagnoses, and about 3/4 of the patients in total, again, out of 100, showed signs of some sort of heart abnormality, many of these being inflammation of the heart, which is known as myocarditis, or inflammation of the tissues surrounding the heart was another one. They also found elevated levels of a protein that indicates that there's been some sort of heart damage. So usually the protein is contained within the heart, and when there's damage to cardiac cells, that protein is released into the surrounding tissue and the bloodstream. So the concern here is that given that such a high rate, even though this was a small study, because so many of the patients showed heart abnormalities, the concern is that even mild cases of COVID-19 could set people up for future heart failure, where if the inflammation and the damage to heart cells is severe enough, that can progress to full-fledged heart failure later on in life. So doctors at this point are doing follow-up studies in larger populations to nail down whether this truly is a common after effect of the virus and how they might mitigate that damage to the heart in the course of infection. Because although we think of COVID-19 as a primarily respiratory illness, it does impact the heart severely, as far as we've seen in wide populations at this point. And it may infect the heart tissue directly, as evidenced in autopsy studies at this point. Again, fairly preliminary evidence, but there are ACE2 receptors in the heart, which is the receptor that the virus plugs into to infect cells. So there's a high possibility that those heart cells can be infected directly by the virus, or at least the blood vessels surrounding that interact with the heart in other ways. Three things to kind of keep an eye on: cross-immunity, CP therapy, and heart abnormalities connected to the coronavirus. And with that, I'm going to hop into your questions from this week. I'm getting a question about reinfection, which we actually touched on pretty heavily in last week's live stream. So if I don't fully answer your question, I'd encourage you to go back to that last week's video, which is still saved on our Facebook, and you can listen in more detail there. What we know about reinfection at this point is that it's highly, highly, highly unlikely. I won't say impossible at this point because we're still actively learning about the virus, but it's far more likely, and there's more evidence to support the idea that rather than people becoming reinfected immediately after their first infection, instead we're just seeing long initial illnesses that have multiple waves. So people think they have recovered but haven't actually recovered. And there's various reasons that you might see that peak and trough of symptoms. And we actually have a full story that details this in more words on the site, a couple stories that touch on this idea of reinfection. At this point, there's not strong evidence to suggest that the virus is finding a so-called reservoir in the body to hide out in. You might think of this in terms of the HIV, because the HIV can lie latent in the body and hide out in tissues and then reincite infection later on. We do not think that's what's happening with this coronavirus at this moment. Rather, it seems that the degree of viral replication simply falls, and you might see symptoms ebb and flow in different people in different ways. Exactly why some people experience really long, persistent infections while others seem to experience very short symptomatic periods, that much is unknown at this point in terms of what sets you up to be at higher risk for a long, drawn-out illness. What I can say is that sometimes people start off with a fairly mild infection and then they end up experiencing more severe symptoms down the line. So there's no guarantee that if you start off with a mild infection, it will stay that way necessarily. But again, we're learning more and more about that. I will just follow up before I conclude on that question to say the evidence for reinfection thus far has primarily been drawn from diagnostic tests for COVID-19, which most of them are based on PCR technology, which simply amplifies whatever virus it can find in the body within the test as it's processed. And if it can detect any virus at all, you get a positive. Now, you can have viral particles lingering in your body for weeks to months after that initial infection. So having a positive test and then a negative test and then a positive test doesn't necessarily mean, number one, that you're still infectious the second time or that you've been reinfected with the virus. Rather, if you're not experiencing new symptoms, it's probably more likely that that's simply dead viral debris that's still circulating in the body. And we see this in other infections where that dead virus continues to circulate until the body naturally clears it. Sometimes immune cells even hang on to dead viral particles. They're kind of harbored in populations of immune cells so that those immune cells can build up their memory of that virus and what it looks like is the basic idea. So that might be happening with this to a certain extent. Now, for people who experience a resurgence in symptoms, it's likely just a long drawn out initial infection. And that middle test of you testing negative for the virus may have been a false result. So that's how you should interpret those reports at this time. I'm getting a question as to whether the virus has mutated in a significantly impactful way at this point. I think kind of the context of this question is, has the virus mutated into a brand new strain yet? And my answer would be no, it has not. What we're seeing circulating are many different lineages of the same virus, as far as we know at this point. Now, when I differentiate between lineages versus a strain, what I'm talking about is essentially an evolutionary tree. So if you're starting out with your original virus here, what happens is you get many mutations within that virus because viruses mutate quickly with each time they replicate. So because viruses replicate so quickly, they have many chances for these mutations to accumulate. So as the mutations are radiating out, the different lineages branch off from that original virus. And if a mutation emerges or a series of mutations emerges that are dramatically different enough and alter the virus's function to the point, especially that it infects cells differently, then you might consider that virus a new strain. And that would be concerning in that obviously vaccines and therapeutics and things like that are based on the strains that we see circulating en masse now. So if the virus changes, the treatments have to change, or you need multiple treatments for different strains of the virus. At this point, the treatments that are being developed are being tested within the different lineages sampled of the virus. And from my understanding, they appear effective against the different lineages to the point that you can't say that there's been a new strain that emerges that is more resistant or more contagious or less contagious, etc. So no, we haven't seen a dramatic functional change associated with mutation. What I will say is that in modeling studies of the possible evolution of the virus, it is possible that the virus could mutate in such a way that it can escape certain antibodies that the body generates. Now, you have many, many different antibodies. So when one antibody doesn't work as effectively anymore, there are others to back it up. So it's a layered system in this way. But viruses do typically mutate in such a way that they're kind of working back and forth with the immune system. So the immune system comes up with new antibodies to target the virus, and the virus fights back, so to speak, in part by mutating in such a way that it can evade those antibodies that have been designed to spot it. This is why when we're talking about antibody cocktail treatments for the coronavirus, where you in a lab generate antibodies by selecting ones that are very potent at neutralizing the virus, putting them together in one drug and giving that to a patient. There are several of these in clinical trials now. The reason they're typically cocktails is because they're more effective the more antibodies you include, just in case the one antibody isn't as effective as another. So something to think about. I'm getting a question rounding back now to how masks reduce face masks, whether cloth or surgical, etc., reduce the spread of the coronavirus. By acting as a physical barrier between your face and other people is the baseline answer. There's been in numerous studies detailing what it looks like for aerosols to seep out of a mouth and respiratory droplets to spray out of a mouth when it's uncovered versus covered. So in that way, by having a physical barrier, and depending on, again, if you're talking about medical grade masks, those are typically better in terms of being better sealed to the wearer's face. So those really trap those particles with the wearer. Whereas cloth masks and looser masks do let some particles seep out the sides. But when you think about it, you have to think about it in terms of fluid dynamics, which describes the movement of fluids like the air surrounding us, of like water, various examples. So if you're thinking about the fluid dynamics of these aerosols and these respiratory droplets, when you have that physical barrier in front of your face, they typically take the path of least resistance. So some will seep out the edges, but generally, because you've disrupted their flow, they will remain closer to that person's face as opposed to spraying out into the world and becoming dispersed. And particularly in poorly ventilated, enclosed, crowded indoor spaces, this becomes important because the particles do not get filtered away by airflow in poorly ventilated spaces. Whereas when you're outside and you're maybe talking to a friend at a decent distance, those aerosols that you're spraying out of your mouth and those particles are going to, the aerosols will be moved around by the air itself and dispersed to a point that the dosage that your friend across the way would breathe in would be far lower than if you were in an enclosed space with them. If you think, so if you're in an elevator versus out in a park somewhere. So that's why we especially emphasize mask wearing in indoor spaces. There is now new evidence that's come out that suggests that if you are wearing a mask, because again, there is a physical barrier between yourself and other people, if someone else sprays viral particles on you, it doesn't guarantee that you won't catch the virus, especially if we're talking about a surgical mask or a cloth mask. Now, N95s designed for healthcare workers do help block out those particles and keep healthcare workers safe, and shields on top of those. But when we're talking about a surgical or a cloth mask, even that barrier appears to be correlated with a milder instance of infection, meaning you are inhaling fewer viral particles if that barrier is in front of your face as compared to if you weren't. Inhaling fewer particles is like taking a smaller dose of some toxic substance, right? So part of infection is the severity is often linked to how many viral particles you inhale in the first place. It's dose dependent, kind of like how some substances aren't toxic until you ingest them at high quantities. So there's a certain threshold that you might contract a milder disease versus a more severe disease. And it seems that mask wearing not only helps those around you, but might result in you having a milder case of the disease, even if you caught the coronavirus. That's where we're at with masks. Wear them, especially when you're close to people in enclosed spaces. I'm getting a question about the prevalence of the heart issues I was talking about earlier in connection with the coronavirus versus lingering lung problems connected with the coronavirus, and they're asking which is the bigger concern. I would say we don't have yet enough evidence in connection with the lingering heart problems to know if it is as prevalent as that small study suggested. So the small, again, only 100 patients included in that first study I mentioned, and about 75 or so had these lingering heart abnormalities, which taken on its own sounds like an enormous number of people. Now, does that small group of people represent everyone who contracts the coronavirus? Maybe, maybe not. Likely not, because it was a very narrow age group and it was specifically conducted in the context of one country, all that sort of thing. So we don't yet know if those results can be generalized to a wider population, which is why they're looking into it in larger studies now. I hesitate to rank one as a larger concern. We're seeing both persistent lung and heart problems emerge as a result of the coronavirus, and both of these systems work in tandem with each other. So if you have a problem with one, you could experience issues with the other. So the heart circulates oxygenated blood to the body. Your lungs are what brings the oxygen in. So if one is compromised, the other has to work harder. So in my mind, the lung and heart issues can be seen on a similar playing field, especially depending on the person. So if you're a person who already has chronic lung issues, and then something else on top of that accrues because of the coronavirus, obviously the lungs might be a bigger issue for you. And if you have a chronic heart condition and that worsens due to the coronavirus, that would be of larger concern. So I think on a more individual basis, it might depend on your pre-existing conditions. But in general, I see them on a similar level of concern because they are so important to daily existence. This is a good question. After a school or office building closes due to a coronavirus outbreak, does doing a deep clean of the building really help? So generally speaking, we've now seen evidence that picking the virus up from a contaminated surface and depositing it onto a vulnerable tissue like your nose or your mouth or your eyes, this is not necessarily the primary route of spread. It's way more likely that you'll inhale the virus, whether in a respiratory droplet or an aerosol. So while frequent hand washing and cleaning surfaces, disinfecting is very important to reducing spread, it does help. It is not the primary route. My hesitation with focusing so much on the primary route is because I don't want to pretend that cleaning surfaces isn't important. It definitely is important. And even just basic hand washing measures, very important. So a deep clean to a certain extent is helpful. The issue becomes with a deep clean is that you have that one instance where you're disinfecting everything to a very minute degree, and then people come back. And are you keeping up that level of cleanliness when people come back? Or are you only doing it when coronavirus cases emerge and nobody's in the building? Because when you need the building to be clean is when people are there, which is why thinking about primary routes of spread, like aerosols and respiratory droplets, helps to inform what we do as individuals in a space. So you can think about washing your hands frequently. You can think about wiping down surfaces frequently. But mostly you want to think about mask wearing, how close you are to other people, what kind of space you're gathering in. These things may be more important, which kind of ties into a question somebody else has asked, which is there evidence that increased ventilation can help slow the spread of coronavirus? And at this point, preliminary evidence, but yes, improved ventilation seems to be associated with a lower risk of passing on the virus to other people. If you want a really specific case study, Israel opened schools not too long ago and for a while had they didn't see a surge in cases in connection to school openings. And then they opened more schools. Initially, they had all the students wearing masks and the windows were being kept open. But then now that we're in summer, there was a heat wave. And they wanted to close the windows to turn on the AC, and they ceased requiring students and faculty to wear masks constantly because masks get more and more uncomfortable the hotter it is, as I'm sure many of you experience. with the combination of factors, they did see a surge in cases, especially among older students, such as middle schoolers and high schoolers. Now, that's partially because there's evidence that middle schoolers and high schoolers spread about as much of the virus as adults do. So that's all connected there. But yes, so that's a very specific case study. But more generally speaking, you're going to see more cases of super spreader events where one infected person spreads the virus to a unusually high number of others. Most of these super spreader events tend to take place indoors. So that gives you a huge hint as well, and especially in poorly ventilated spaces. So yes, increased ventilation, I almost think should be held as a greater importance than constant deep cleaning. Because really, if you're washing your hands personally frequently enough, not every single surface in a school or a building has to be clean all the time, meaning like just wiped off with an alcohol wipe kind of clean. Because if you're washing your hands, that cuts the route of transmission to you. Whereas ventilation, you have to breathe. So what you should think about is upping the ventilation improves the dilution of viral particles. So they're being able to disperse better, which means there's a lower chance that you inhale enough to incite a meaningful infection. I'm seeing mostly questions that already relate to things I touched on earlier. So I'm actually going to wrap up there. Thank you again for tuning in. And we may have updates next week about a possible new format for the live stream or some other video series that would be related or in replacement of. We'll keep you updated on all of that information. This is our 27th live stream to date, so might think about starting to switch up how we do things. If you do have any thoughts towards that, stick them in the comments below. Always nice to hear back from people who tune in and hang out with us for this hour on Thursdays. And with that, I will say goodbye for the week.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals network.